My name is Scott Dickens. I work on the Windows team, and my team is responsible for building sort of the platform behind these Metro-style apps. So we're going to have lots of fun today. I realize it's the after-lunch slot. Things are going a little slow, so I'll try to keep things up-tempo, fast-paced, interesting. And so I need to start with a little confession and a story. And so a while ago, it doesn't seem like that long ago, but it's actually a really, really long time ago now, I was in business school. And so I was in business school because I have two undergraduate majors. I have nothing to do with technology. And it turns out you can't get a job as a musician. You can't get a job with political science degrees, et cetera. And so my parents convinced me, hey, you need to go to business school. So I went to business school. And when you're in business school, you pick a concentration. And most people pick like marketing and finance, these big, strong business level concentrations. And I thought that was super boring. I didn't understand that at all. And so they had a concentration that was like information systems. And I was like, hey, you know, I play computer games. Like, I'm a classically trained Commodore 64 gamer. How hard can this computer stuff be? And so my first class, we were asked to design the website for the school. And so bonus points if you can figure out, based on the purple and gold colors, what school that was. And so here is the website. Let's take a look at this for a minute. There is one, and only one, really egregious mistake with this website. Can anybody see that? This is the first test after lunch. Come on, folks. No. You guys got it totally wrong. The answer was, there's only one mistake? Come on, dude. There's like 50 mistakes on this website. So this period piece here is a period correct representation of the web around 1996 to 97. And you can notice the period correct usage of things like frames pages, of tables, of animated GIFs. Like, we were promoting animated GIFs. Like, look at that emoticon, how awesome is that? And then the Java and the Java applets, oh man, this is amazing. And so the long story short here is that, hey, even at the time, you could create some pretty interesting stuff using web technologies. It turns out that you can also create some incredibly bad things using web technology. And I feel like my job here as sort of guide and chaperone is to get you guys excited about Metro-style apps and HTML5, and also sort of describe at this web developer connection level the things that you need to know in order to build great apps, because otherwise you might end up building sort of the Metro version of this, and I don't want that. And so let me start with sort of a quick tour of these Metro-style apps and what I mean. I have touch feedback enabled, so that's why you can see it's sort of the pointer. And so let's start by looking at an existing sort of HTML5-y website. And so this is Bing Finance. You may have been there before. It's like the everyday sort of typical website as you see them now. Like, lots of white background, blah, blah, blah. It gets the point across in terms of financials. It's not super touch friendly. Like, you can see, like, I'm trying to touch this. Yeah, sort of. Wait, I zoomed. That's not really working from a touch perspective. But it does get the point across. It's very usable with a mouse and keyboard. Let's take a look at sort of the Metroized version of that. So there's a Bing Finance app. By the way, you can get all of these applications if you install the Windows 8 release preview, which is available on our website for free, and the tools that I'm showing also available for free. And so here's sort of the Metro version of that particular app. And you can see the very first thing is it's all about content. The Chrome is completely stripped away. It's only the content of this particular site. They own every pixel that's on the screen. This app does. And then the panning. And notice that instead of panning sort of and scrolling vertically, we're panning horizontally. And notice the uses of font. And then charts. And then articles. And then some of the stocks I care about. Hey, actually up today. And then other integration with the operating system. Like, here's a little fun thing. Let's take a look and see how our friends Facebook are doing. Everybody's happy they bought that Facebook stock, right, at the IPO? Wait, I'm looking at the wrong view. Hold on. That's the view. And so, it's all in good fun. Sorry, Facebook. Just to give you a sense of sort of that Metro-style design, that metro-style pattern, and the power that you can do. And so sort of our first natural inclination as web devs is like, hey, how do I take my existing web property and code, and how do I port that as quickly as possible over to a metro-style app? And yes, there's lots of code reuse. And yes, there's like 100% skills reuse. But my ask to you is to start looking at it through the lens of building a metro app, not how do I port my existing thing. Because I think if you port, you end up with a totally different experience than something like this, which was fresh and unique and a redesign of something modern of their particular application. So hopefully that sort of sets the stage here for the rest of the stuff that we're going to talk about. Yes? Yes. So our agenda today, we're going to talk through five different things. And again, this is all along the way to building great metro-style apps in HTML5. So the first is around packages and the app model. So we'll kind of describe some fundamentals, some basics. The second is around the web platform, the thing that hosts these particular applications. The third is around this thing called WinRT, or the Windows Runtime, that you've probably heard about. The fourth is this process lifecycle thing. We need to think about how users interact and run our app differently. And the last is a little pivot on the enterprise, and I'll give you some features and things to think about as you're building apps in the enterprise space. We're going to talk about these first three sort of together, and sort of this is sort of the framing diagram. We're going to talk about app packages first. And so the first concept that you should understand is that as web devs, I think we sort of fundamentally understand how our code gets to client machines, right? Like, you write the code, you publish it, it goes onto some server somewhere, like I'm hand-waving, goes onto some server somewhere, like client in browser connects to that server, code comes over the wire and gets presented. And so that notion sort of is very different in this app building world. Like, you're going to take your files, that HTML, the CSS, and JavaScript, the things that make up your app, and you're going to bundle them, and you're going to put them in this container. And this container is essentially a zip file. And then that zip file gets to the user's machine. And you basically have only three ways to get that data, binaries, et cetera, to the user's machine. And this is because all apps get signed. There's no such thing as like installing an unsigned app. So all apps are signed, which means that all apps are trusted in some way, shape, or form. And the first and most common experience for users is going to be getting the app from the App Store. When they get that app from the App Store, it'll be signed by Microsoft. Windows already implicitly trusts the cert from the store. Poof, now your app is on the client's machine and it's running. The second way that you can do it is you, as developers, obviously need a way to run an app. And you need a way to run an app while you're developing it. And so there's this notion of a developer license. That's what signs your bits, et cetera. Then the third way is sort of what we'll call enterprise sideloading. That's a fancy way to say that if you're in an enterprise, you probably have some trusted root cert for your enterprise. You use that to sign your app, and thus any machines that also trust that same cert can run that application. And so there's some caveats, other stuff to go along with that. Happy to talk about that afterwards. Also, I guess I failed to mention, we sort of have a packed agenda, and so questions at the end, awesome. Questions along the way, harder, because we're trying to get through this, because it's after lunch. So this is sort of the first notion. Your app gets packaged. And let's go ahead and take a quick look at that in Visual Studio. So here I am in Visual Studio. This is Visual Studio Express. Which interestingly enough, when you try to search for it on the start menu, if you type in visual, it does not find it because it's VS Express Visual Studio. And so we're going to start with just a new project. There's a set of templates. Anybody care what template I start with? Am I good? I can choose whatever? Okay. Everybody still alive? So we'll just call it demo app. I chose the grid app because nobody yelled at me. And so here we are with sort of a blank template. And so for now, let's just concentrate on sort of the contents of this particular package. So here's my app, demo app. And in it, there's a default HTML. You should notice sort of over on the left-hand side, it's just HTML as we know it. There's nothing fancy here, no trickery, no smoke and mirrors. There's a JavaScript folder in that there's JavaScript files like this default JS. This is JavaScript. Again, no smoke and mirrors, no trickery. There's a CSS folder with CSS. You guys get the idea. And then in it, there's other folders where resources could live. On your particular, for your particular app package, you could add any existing item that you would like. You can create new folders and a whole folder structure. Everything that you see here in Visual Studio, everything that's part of that project, is the thing that gets wrapped up and bundled into your app's package. And so to create one, the good guys in Visual Studio have a menu item called Create App Package. And so if you choose yes to this particular dialog, it means you're trying to upload your package directly to the Windows Store, which we are not doing. So we want a local package. Then on this screen, if everybody could please help me memorize the exact path, we're going to need that later. And then the next thing that you should notice is sort of this platform designation. So we're writing web code. And really, like, I love to make it sound more glamorous than it sometimes is. But right now, like, these are just text files. Like, that's all they are. And then, like, they get compiled in the sense that they get parsed and jitted at runtime, but they're just text files. Like, we're not building an XE here. We're not building DLLs. And so the architecture, if you will, like we talked about Windows being able to run on lots of different form factors, the x86 convertible PC, the x64 workstation, the ARM slate, like the beauty of the web is that it runs across all of those. And so the notion of like what platform is this, it's neutral. It runs across all of them. Like, you built this web app, and now, of course, it runs on the ARM slate. Of course, it runs on the x64 machine. Of course, it runs on the x86 machine. And so we're building this neutral package. And we created it. Everybody memorized the path, right? I didn't get that. Thankfully, the good folks at Visual Studio thought about that and provided a link. And so in this directory that we get all of the goodies that we now need in order to deploy our app. And so, like, if you're building your app and you want your buddy to go test the app, this is how you give them that app. And let's take a further look at this. So the first is there's a cert, and that was the cert used to sign that particular app. The next is there's a PowerShell script, and the PowerShell script uses some native PowerShell infrastructure to add appx package, meaning fancily, please add this app to the system. And then the next thing is the appx package, which is your app. And so, like I said before, this was just really a zip file. And so we'll just rename it to .zip and take a look inside. And if I can set up Visual Studio right, we can take a look at these side by side. And so just like in Visual Studio, we had our default.html, we have our default HTML here in the package. Just like in Visual Studio, we have a folder called JS with JavaScript in it. We have the same thing here. And so now you guys can sort of see, like visually, really, really see, the fact that this package is the exact set of contents that you're developing within Visual Studio. So that's the notion of your app, what it is, and how it gets to users' machines. So let's take a further look at this real quick. And with any of these templates, as soon as you create the template, you're able to run that particular app. So all I did was just F5 and run it. And so there's nothing fancy in it, it's just it's itself the template. But let's go back and take a look at what's running. So the first thing that you'll see here, which is also different than the web world that we know, is that this is your app and your app's brand. And so even in like sort of lower level things like Task Manager, you see demo app. You don't see like Microsoft Windows for Metro style app for HTML5 parentheses something or other. Like this is all about your app getting like all the glory. And so we do see that there. But as I said, like we're not building XE, so something has to be running this. What's that? And so on the details page, you'll see this other thing called WWA host. People sort of looked at me funny with the dub. So like in quick sidebar, In Seattle, there's a university. It's called University of Washington. And so the shortened version of that is sort of U of W. But that sounds weird. And it's not W-U. And so they shortened it, and they call it Dub. So it's U-Dub. And so hence Dub. No? OK. Dub. As I was saying, wwahost.exe is the thing that runs and powers these Metro-style apps in HTML5. And so that sort of completes our first look at the packages piece. And let's drill in further to the web platform part. So most modern browsers today, and I bring up browsers because those are the things that are running your websites as they exist today, sort of have this notion of a frame process, if you will, and a tab process. The frame process is sort of the outer chrome of your browser. That's the thing that has an address bar and a back button and forward buttons sometimes and history and favorites. And it has all of those notions of the thing that we call a browser today. So if your mental model is strip that away, and then all you're left with is sort of the tab, which is really the thing that has the engine that runs your HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. That piece, that tab, if you will, is essentially akin to what that WWA host process does. Like, think of it as a tab of the browser. And so it has all of the same capabilities. In fact, the web platform that you see here on this fancy diagram is the same web platform that powers the Internet Explorer 10 browser, with some changes, in a good way. And so as I was explaining to a few folks sort of before the session, like one of the major pain points as a web developer was that I always had to do what I'll call lowest common denominator programming. I'd have to ask, hey, what's the lowest level of browser that I have to support? Damn you, IE6. Damn you, IE7. And then I would use libraries like Modernizer, et cetera, to sort of stack new technologies and functionality on top of this lowest common denominator. And I was always really upset that I had to do that. And so with these Metro-style apps in HTML5, you get a single doc type. So there's no quirks mode, there's no other standards modes, et cetera. There's only the one thing, and it's the latest and greatest. And the beauty of this particular platform is that unlike with the browser support today, where you're like, oh, what browser is running on Windows XP, what browser is running on Windows 7, et cetera, you can guarantee that all Windows 8 users get this level of functionality. It's just a Windows 8 app. All Windows 8 PCs get this functionality. The second thing is that it's the standards web, and it's plug-in free. So sorry, that means no Silverlight, no Flash within these particular Metro-style apps. But you do get the Windows runtime, which I'll sort of get into later, as sort of the additional set of capabilities beyond the web platform. The next thing is sort of the single window notion. And I think, like you guys, like, I am going to be so happy when one day I can go to weather.com and not have a pop-up. I don't understand why that website can't, not to single out that website, but I need to single out that website. I don't understand why that website still is trying to do pop-ups. And like browsers put in all these protections. It's like, I have a pop-up blocker. Do you want that? Yes or no? Of course I want it. Do I want it in the intranet zone? Do I want it in the internet zone? How does all this work? And like in the Metro-style app world, as you saw, your app gets every pixel on the screen, but you only need to manage a single window. And so you don't have to do crazy like posting of messages across different windows, et cetera, to make these things communicate. You don't have to worry about which window is actually showing. There's only one window. The next thing is that it's very, very, very common as like the first step of building, especially front-end websites today. It's like, hey, what library am I going to use to make my life easier? And like most people, it's jQuery. But it could be Dojo, it could be YUI, it could be Prototype, it could be Modernizer, it could be any combination of libraries. And you generally use those libraries for a couple of reasons. And so we built a library called the Windows Library for JavaScript, or WinJS for short, to help you in your Metro-style app development. And of course, you can still use our library in conjunction with others like Dojo and et cetera. Or you could just choose not to use our library at all. But I think you're going to want to, and here are the reasons. First, when I showed you that quick demo of the template or the finance app, you could see that it had that particular look and feel to it. Like, it had controls. And, like, those controls are purely written in JavaScript. Could you write your own control to do the same thing? Sure. But we're giving you one. Like, why would you spend time recreating that? It also has sort of that look and feel in terms of, like, simple things like animations. Like, as I panned, you could notice that there was, like, it moved at a particular speed. And then as it hit the end, it bounced. And, like, you can recreate all of those animations because they're just CSS animations. But why would you? Like, the Windows library for JavaScript gives you all of that look and feel for free, essentially. And users will love you if you use that, because they'll have this consistent user experience across different devices and across different apps. So there's a whole talk on deeper dives into the WinJS stuff if you're interested, and those are in the session details here at the end. The other thing that the Windows library for JavaScript gives you is sort of helper functionality. And so just like with jQuery, like using dollar sign instead of get element by ID, like score, win, there's a bunch of sort of helper libraries in WinJS. And here's a great example of that. As I went through the app, you could notice that like as I navved, I was changing content within that app, but there was no like clicking sound. There was no like white flash and then like another page loading. It felt like an app. And if I didn't tell you that it was built in HTML, like you'd probably go, oh, that's probably built in C# and XAML or whatever. Like, it didn't feel like I was navigating around a website. There was no clicking with like blue links and stuff. And so this notion of how an app navigates now has changed. It's sort of that Ajax model plus plus. It's that I load a single document and then I load fragments into that document as my navigation. I'm not really going page to page to page. And so WinJS gives you that functionality. And so lots to explore there in the WinJS library. I just wanted to call that out, because as web developers, our natural inclination is to take the thing that we know and then make it work in the new environment. And of course you can do that, and you're encouraged to do that. But I'd also encourage you to really, really look at the Windows library for JavaScript, because it will make your life super simple and easy as you build out these Metro-style apps. So that's sort of our web platform coverage. So let's dive into the WinRT platform. So one thing around the running app that I did not mention is this notion of an app container. And I always sort of like waffle when I talk about the app container, because it's not really a security boundary or a sandbox. But if I say it's a sandbox or a security boundary, then people go, okay, I get it. And so it's not those things, but it's a lot like those things. And so really, the app container is there for app isolation. And as a web developer, what that means to us is it helps us do the right thing. It helps our app stay as our app. And then when it needs to interact with the system or other apps, it does through defined ways. And so we don't have to worry about sort of leaving stuff all over the operating system or cleaning up after ourselves or any of those other things. We don't have to worry about accidentally doing the wrong thing, because the app container sort of saves us from that. As a developer, we like the app container. And so I bring it up because you're going to want to call Windows Runtime APIs. And Windows Runtime is sort of our fancy way of saying, you get to call Windows APIs. And as a web developer, this is awesome. Because our play area before was whatever was in the web platform. So we had to rely on sort of, if the capability's in HTML5, sure, I can use it. The capabilities in CSS3, sure, I can use it. And those were sort of the set of capabilities. But you were never able to sort of call out to the operating system and get more work done. And if you needed to do those things, generally, then you got a plugin. Like, I got Silverlight so that I can do blah. I got Flash so I can do blah. And then you went and wrote native code. And so the power of the Windows runtime is that we give you access to these Windows APIs, this full set of rich Windows APIs. And you're doing it all through JavaScript. There's no native code involved. But some of those calls do require sort of brokering, if you will. Meaning, your app is running in this protective, sandboxy type thing, and you need to get access to some system resource, like a file for the user. And by default, your app in that app container doesn't have access to those things. And if you think about it, this is really no different than the way it works on the web right now. So if you were ever in Outlook Web Access, composing a new mail, hit attach to like find a file, and then you got the system dialog that came up that allowed you to browse for the file, you were already going through a broker. That system file dialog to choose the file, that was your broker. The same thing happens with Gmail. The same thing happens with Yahoo Mail. So that notion already exists. And so you, when you call some Windows runtime APIs, you go through a broker. Sometimes you need to care about going through a broker. And in those particular instances, you need to care about this thing called the manifest. The manifest is part of your package, and it sort of serves two different purposes. One is around deployment. It's the thing that tells the operating system, like, my app, Foo, wants to register as the Foo file handler. Like, it tells the OS those things. It also has some runtimey components to it. And one of those runtime components is whether or not you need access to certain devices. For example, if you want access to the user's location, you declare that in the manifest. And then later, when you go to use it, sometimes location is sort of a good example of that, where the user would still need to consent to that because there's some time sensitivity piece to that. For instance, like if I'm here in the room and somebody wants, you know, the machine wants to know my location, good. If I, you know, snuck off to Vegas or something, I probably wouldn't want it knowing my location. And so I bring this up because most of the Windows runtime stuff, which is sort of this list of APIs, this super deep, rich list of APIs, is just available to you. But sometimes you need to care about the manifest. And those instances are super documented, super well documented on MSDN. So three key takeaways around the Windows runtime. The first is you can see the deep set of APIs here just by the names. Like, hey, I get access to encrypted data? Awesome. Like, I get access to the photo library? Awesome. Like, I totally did not have that as a web dev before. The second is, as I mentioned, it surfaced naturally in JavaScript. There's no writing native code in order to get access to these APIs. And then the third is that you can write your own. So picture this. There's a bunch of sort of experiments on the web right now that try to push the boundaries of what's possible in a browser. And so somebody, do you guys know what ray tracing is? Like it's this sort of, okay, then the one hand in the room, yes, I know. maybe I should back away from the ray tracing example. So there's this thing called ray tracing. Basically, the computer science project, et cetera, the whole intent of it is to like prove how powerful like processing can be. And so like somebody wrote a ray tracer in JavaScript. And then they use that to try to like benchmark, like how fast can our JavaScript engines go? Can they do this ray tracing example? Yes. And so like, sure, we could do that. And like JavaScript engines are certainly getting faster. But like, it's sort of a moot point, like if you could include a C++ library or a C# library to do the same thing. And with the Windows runtime, you can. Like, you don't have to have all of the processing in your app be JavaScript. Like, you can write your own C# layer that does lots of logic. You could write your own C++ layer that does lots of logic. It could even power your data model. And then you can call that thing directly from JavaScript and talk between the two. And so some of the power of the Windows runtime, like this is how we use it to talk to these Windows APIs, which are clearly not written in JavaScript, right? Those are written in C and C++. And so we use the same thing to talk to Windows APIs, and you can write your own WinRT API and call it from within your app. And so some of the power of the Windows runtime. Let's take a look at that sort of in action here. So I'm in Visual Studio, and let me pull up a different project. This particular project is an SDK sample called the File Picker. You can find this on msdn.com, and then like there's a Metro development area, then there's samples, you can search for the sample. Like I have not doctored the sample at all. And so there's this File Picker sample, and let me go ahead and run it and I'll show you what I mean. And so it has four different examples. We'll just go through the first one, which is picking a single photo. And you can pick a photo, and then this dialog right here goes through the broker. And so this is system drawn UI. It's very friendly, touch friendly, et cetera. I can use it, I can pick a picture, et cetera. This is my picture from before. And so I broke into the debugger because I had set a breakpoint there earlier. And so those of us that have done lots of web development sort of know, hey, there's this window object. And sure enough, it's there, just like I would expect. But there's this other object, Windows. And in this particular namespace is where the Windows runtime set of APIs live. And you can see lots of cool stuff in here, like there's app model, there's data, there's devices, and as you drill in further, there's more layers of nesting until more APIs and more APIs and more APIs. There are a lot of APIs. And they're all there to help you build great Metro-style apps. So like, you want to interact with users' data, there's APIs for that. You need to save state along the way, there's APIs for that. You need to get access to location, there's APIs for that. So this full, rich API set. And so calling out, like as you go to build your first Windows Metro-style app, you'll see this Windows namespace. And going back above and sort of looking at the code, you can see that like we're not doing anything fancy. This is regular JavaScript. Like, again, no smoke and mirrors here. So like, hey, I created a new like instance of this Windows storage pickers file open picker thingy. Like, all very familiar. It's only the namespace that's really different. And then you can see the type of stuff that I do with it and the methods that are on it. Like, hey, when you pull that up, show it in thumbnails mode as opposed to details. Hey, like, I want you to start in the pictures library. Hey, I only want PNGs and JPEGs. Like, all of these sort of customization options that you would sort of expect if you were calling to open a file picker. So that's sort of the Windows runtime in brief. And there's a whole another session, I think it directly follows this, probably not in this room though, on the Windows runtime where you can get your fill of, it's a really good deep session on the Windows runtime. And so in that example, we sort of talked about local data. By the way, is everybody doing all right? Like, heads are nodding, it's after lunch. Sorry, going fast. So we talked a lot about local data, and that's what that example was about. Like, hey, I'm using the file picker to go get a photo. But we often use web data, like web services, JSON feeds, RSS feeds, et cetera. And so how does all that work in this model? And so here's probably the most difficult sort of conceptual thing that I have to describe today, which is this notion of context. And so the best way to talk about this is to talk about something that you guys already know, which is site of origins. And so when you're building an app today and your site of origin is foo, that means certain restrictions within the browser. Like, you don't get to talk to bar if you're foo, except via certain methods. Like, how do I do these things? Oh, okay. Let's talk through what it means in sort of the web environment. The first thing that you see is that our site of origin is not HTTP colon my app whatever. It's this ms-apex thing. That's my package. And no, there's not a typo there with the three slashes. The third slash is merely an alias to your package. It's the easy way to sort of reference it, if you will. It's the relative URL to your package. And so that package, the one that we described before, the one that exists in the .apex file, if you will, the things that you're building in Visual Studio, that's trusted content. That's content that you wrote. It's JavaScript that you wrote. And in that particular context, we allow you to talk to the Windows runtime. But browsers have a particular security model for a reason. And that's because there's a whole lot of untrusted content out there. An incredible amount of untrusted content. And so browsers sandbox the set of capabilities generally to those just in the web platform. And you can see with the Windows runtime, we're going way beyond the web platform. But we need to figure out a way to still keep you as developers and the end users that run your app safe. Safe from malicious content from the web. And that's what the web context is for. So in the local context, your script, the script that comes as part of your package, can call Windows runtime. If you try to reference remote script, like HTTP colon blah, 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 you know, myscript.js or whatever, we don't let you do that. We don't let you take remote script from the web and call the Windows runtime APIs because it's not safe. We don't know that script. It's not trusted. We only trust the script that you wrote, the script that you put in your package. And so if you need to display website content like that, or if you need the capabilities of a remote script, that's what the web context is for. And so generally, you'd see it referenced as this HTTP colon whatever. Any type of references to script there, you know you're using the web context. When you set up your iframe and you go source equals and it starts with HTTP colon whatever, you're in the web context. And in that web context, the same rules of the browser apply. You cannot call the Windows runtime from there because it's untrusted script. So trusted script, local context, you get to call the Windows runtime. Untrusted script, web context, you don't get to call the Windows runtime. And so you say, well, how do I talk between the two? Like, I have this iframe model. How does that work? And so HTML5 post message is your friend. You send along strings, so, you know, JSON stringify, and then send it along. So real world example, you need to integrate a map, like Bing Maps or Google Maps, into your HTML5 app. How do you do that? And so you build a local context, and that's the main page of your app. That's the thing that talks to Windows runtime, and it has to talk to Windows runtime for reasons that I'll get into in just a minute. And then you set up an iframe, and the iframe holds the map. And then you talk between the two using PostMessage. So like a very, very typical app architecture where you'll run into this local context, web context piece. And of course, both of those, the local context and the web context, get to call HTML5 APIs, all the W3C APIs. It's really only the Windows runtime piece that sort of gets turned off in the web context. So let me try to put all this together. Like, very, very common pattern is to use XHR to go get data. And in a browser today, you can't do cross-domain XHR without doing some fancy stuff, like cores and et cetera, et cetera. But if you were writing your own C# app or your own C++ app, there's no, like, domain restrictions. You just XHR to everybody. And in an HTML5 Metro-style app, you XHR to everybody. From the local context, XHR to everybody. And so when you do that, you're going to get back a bunch of data. And as long as you get back sort of HTML, great. It just goes right into your app. If you try to XHR and get script, which is common as well, and you try to inject that into your local context, we sanitize it. We strip out the script. We run it through a method called toStaticHTML. And the reason we do that is, again, to keep you safe. So you think you're XHRing with a partner, and you're getting back just HTML, but it turns out they gave you some script, and then that script calls into the Windows runtime and does malicious things. That would be bad. And so to protect you and to protect users, we sanitize that. And if you really need to get around it, come talk to me afterwards, and I'll talk to you about how to walk around with a loaded gun. But for the most part, like XHR, you will just get back HTML. Like, we'll strip out the script. Untrusted content, what do I do with that? Please put it in an iframe. And now, in the web platform, we also support the sandbox attributes on the iframe, so you can get even more granular. Like, I only want this iframe, and it won't have script access. I only want this iframe, and it will only have these set of capabilities. And then the last thing to sort of mention is that this web host, if you will, this application host, gives you lots of power, but it does not give you the power to build a browser. Sorry. And so what that means is that you might be tempted to go, man, I'm just going to start showing all these websites in iframes, and I'll just nab between them and stuff. Well, just remember, you don't have a back button. You don't have an address bar. You don't have history. Like, you don't really have that navigation stack to do that. And so if you find yourself in the position of designing an app where I need to go to website to website to website to website, like, our answer is really the browser is the right place for that. And so there's APIs that you can use to sort of launch the browser. So just sort of pointing that out as well. So we've gone through sort of a lot of things already. We talked about the packages in the app model. We talked about the web platform. We talked about the WinRT platform. Let me talk for just a quick second about process lifecycle and what that means. And to do that, we sort of need to do another demo. So I'm about to launch another app, and this is the weather app. And you'll note what happens here. Like, when I click on this particular tile, some magic happens under the covers. And that magic is somebody needs to stand up an instance of that web host, and then it needs to navigate to your app. Because, again, we're not building XEs, we're building HTML pages. And so you specify that entry point in your manifest. So when you click that, then the splash screen shows, and then it gets torn down, and then your app displays. which is very different than how it works on the web today, right? Like you click on an address, there's like a click, and then like a white screen, and then like your app starts loading and it trickles in. And like we've all done all the tricks to make the app trickle in the right way so it appears like it's loading faster, et cetera. In the app world here, like the splash screen is there to sort of entertain the user. And then when the splash screen gets dismissed, the expectation on the user's part is that your app is immediately there and usable. And so in this app world, use the splash screen as sort of the curtain. And then when the curtain gets removed, it's like, oh, the actors are there, they're all dancing. Like, your app should be ready to go. So that's sort of the first piece, and we call that activation, launching of your app. The second piece is that while using your app, I might change things. Like, oh yeah, by the way, we were in Redmond. I don't know if you noticed, like, surprise, it's raining in Seattle. And so here we are in Orlando. Looks like we're gonna get lightning on. And so I'm a user, I'm using this app, I'm changing things, et cetera. And like, hey, I'm gonna switch away from your app. Let's go back to Task Manager. We were looking here earlier at the WWA host. And note the status column. And notice how it changed from running to suspended. It was running, now suspended. And so when I switched away from the app lost focus. Now I'm over here in the desktop. I could be in another Metro app. But when your app loses focus, the operating system now will suspend your app, which is sort of akin to breaking into that app with a native debugger. It like starves it of CPU. Think of it that way. It like blocks all CPU access for it. And so it's still there. It's in memory. And like if you give it CPU cycles, it would run again. But this is the way that we start to get really great battery life for Metro apps. When your app is not in the foreground, when the user's not directly interacting with it, we stop it. But the user expectation is that when they go back to the app, that, hey, it's back in the exact same place. And of course it is. But along the way, memory pressure and other circumstances might cause the operating system to do more than just pause your app, to actually close it. And so there are user affordances for close, but in general, we don't expect users to close apps. It's sort of like on my iPad. Like, yes, I did say that, on my iPad. Like, hey, there's a way to close apps on an iPad and iPhone. Like, you know, we know about it. My parents don't know about it. Like, they don't close apps. And so in general, I don't think you'd expect users to close apps, though there are affordances for it. And so rather, the operating system sort of manages all that. And if there's memory pressure, low risk system resources, et cetera, it will start closing apps. And then again, though, to the user, like they don't know the app was closed. It was just closed by the OS. And when they go back to that app, they expect to be sort of in the same place. And so it's your job as an app developer now to think about those things. Like now you're building apps. You have to think about saving off your state. And as web developers, our natural inclination is to use things like cookies. Like, hey, that's how we store state right now. And there's web standards as well. There's IndexedDB, there's web storage, DOM storage, local storage, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, you can use all those things. There's also WinRT APIs. And the Windows Library for JavaScript does a really, really good job of wrapping those Windows runtime APIs and hooking the system events so that you know when you get suspended and resumed and all of those other things. And so it can be a real savior for you. The last thing that I wanted to show real quick before I switch back, I don't know if you guys noticed before, but like some people in the audience are probably saying, oh, I didn't go to suspended last time he was showing me this. And so that's because if you're actively building and debugging your app, it would be a real shame if the operating system came along and suspended your app while you're trying to debug it. And so Visual Studio tells the operating system, please don't suspend my app, I'm debugging it. And so then that presents a new challenge to you as developers, is like, well, how the heck do I test this? Like, I'm debugging my app. I need it to suspend. I got to figure out if I'm loading state correctly. And there's a menu option in Visual Studio for that. Helps you with suspend and resume. And you can even do the case where, like, you've suspended and then the OS terminates you. So, pro tip. So, kind of putting all that together, what we just saw, like, users click on the tile and they launch your app. Your app's running. Code's running, et cetera, et cetera. When you get moved to the background, you get suspended. From there, you get one of two things. You either get resumed or you get terminated. The challenge is that if you get terminated, you are not notified of termination. You're only notified that you were suspended, which means you do all the work as if you might get terminated, though you might not. So the only event you get again, suspended. You never get an event for terminated. You just get shot in the head. That's it. Sorry. The last thing that I wanted to talk about the process lifecycle piece is activation. And so us web developers, myself included, we're kind of lazy about which events to sort of hook on startup. And so most frameworks out there use onload, which is like body.onload. It's like, hey, my page is ready, and we use that. Unfortunately, like in the cycle of events and loading of your page, that's pretty far along. And so if you hook onload as sort of the indicator that your app is ready, one of two things happens. Either the splash screen shows forever and ever and ever and ever and ever, and like finally body.onload fires, and so your splash screen was showing for a long time. By the way, if it shows for longer than 15 seconds, the operating system thinks you're hung, and so shoots you in the head. The other thing that can happen with body.onload is that the splash screen tears down, but your app is really not yet ready because you're still doing async calls and other stuff like that to try to go get data. And so the user sees like this half-complete page, which is totally, again, what we don't want. Like when the splash screen disappears, the user expectation is that they can immediately use your app. And so there's a set of events here. Some of those you control, some of them you don't. But basically, you get an activation event, you do a set of work, and then if you need to, like the regular operating system splash screen will disappear after 750 milliseconds. That's the earliest. And it will extend longer if you don't return from the call or handle that activation event. But you can set up your own splash screen, and you'll notice some apps that do that. Like a good example of that is the Windows Store. So when you download the release preview bit, just launch the store. And you'll see like it gets this cool little animation, and then it goes away, and then like the store puts their own animation there. It says like, we're loading the store, please be patient, or whatever it says. And then eventually that will get torn down, and then the app is ready to use. And so don't be afraid to use an extended splash screen. It's there for you. And do use these particular events. And so another place where WinJS really, really helps you. Like it understands sort of, I do this work at DOM content loaded. I do this set of work on the activation event. I do this set of work in order to fire that my page is ready. And so it will help you do the right thing in terms of standing up your app and having the best user experience. So that sort of wraps up the process lifecycle bit. In the last little piece, and I promise we're almost done, I just wanted to talk about three things that sort of relate directly to enterprise development. That are particularly interesting for you guys that may not be as interesting to other software developers. The first is there's a set of capabilities, and these capabilities are sort of rightfully restricted when you try to upload an app to the App Store. Like one of those that I'll call out here is enterprise authentication. And so when you're building a line of business app, it'd be super common for you to want, hey, I need to get this user's domain creds, and then I'm going to go do something with it. And like, really, really valid business case for having that. And so there's a capability in the manifest that allows that to work with app containers. But for regular apps, like if I uploaded the Twitter app to the App Store and like I needed to get your domain credentials for the Twitter app, probably not. Like I'm probably being malicious. And so there's this set of capabilities, and like some of the other ones on here, like the private network client server, that's intranet, as opposed to internet. That's how you get like LAN access. Another one for shared user certs. The second thing is around security and privacy. And like you've probably heard through the press, and you will hear more and more about the ability to sort of roam settings as a key capability to Metro apps. Like I have this set of settings on this one device. I get to go to my PC, and it has like the same set of settings because they were roamed. There's lots of really, really good reasons to do that. In an enterprise space, there are also probably reasons not to want to roam things. And so just be conscious of like what settings you're storing where, because when you store the settings, there's like a local and a app data and a roaming. And like if you put stuff in the roaming, it roams. So like, just be conscious of that. Like, only use that stuff if you really wanted that data to roam. Another thing is that by default, like, we will use HTTP and HTTPS connections. But if you're building a particularly sensitive line of business app, like an expense approval app or something like that, you can force all traffic to be HTTPS. So there's a capability for that. And then the last thing is just thinking about offline. Like, we talk so much about sort of, hey, everything is always on, always connected nowadays. But the reality is that, like, I was coming out here and, like, I'm on this 5-hour plane ride where I'm not connected. And, like, I still want to get stuff done. And so I'd encourage you guys to think about how your app would work, even if it was in, like, a disconnected or an occasionally connected state. And there's lots of great HTML5 features that the platform supports to enable this. So there's App Cache, there's IndexedDB, but there are also WinRT capabilities for this as well. And then as you think through that, make sure that you think about the pivot of my app's binaries, which by definition they were in the package, so they're able to run offline, but also the data that you would need in order to run offline. So think about those two things as you look to build out your enterprise apps. So just kind of quickly summing up, like, we didn't do a ton of coding, but we did show some pretty powerful stuff. And, like, it really wasn't a lot of lines of code. Like, it really is simple and fast and powerful. And, like, back to my example at the beginning, please, please, please don't build this. The world does not need another this. But I would encourage you to build something like this, something that is Metro-style enabled, something that is powerful, something that is immersive. And so I do want to thank you guys for coming out, even right after lunch. I realize, like, it's not the best time slot. I'm here to answer questions. Enjoy the rest of the conference. Thank you, guys.